This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Well, welcome everybody to this plenary. My name is Mandy Telford. I was an advisor to the government and a trade union official in my past. I'm currently taking time out to do my most exhausting job of being a mum to a toddler that is marauding around out there somewhere, but I will be removing her after this session, so don't worry. We have a very distinguished panel here today, and I'm sure we're going to have a very good debate. So Labour left government, having taken historic measures to save the economy from the biggest international crash since the Great Depression. We saved people's savings, halted a million jobs being lost, and kept home repossessions way below the levels they reached in the 80s. But after the election, the coalition has constantly trashed our economic record, blaming the previous government for the size of the deficit. Polls, and I'm sure Ben's going to touch on this, polls have indicated that the public still don't trust Labour to run the economy and blame the party over the coalition for the cuts. So the question is, if economic credibility is the prerequisite for winning elections, how do we meet this challenge? First to speak to you today is Angela Eagle, who is currently Shadow Chief Secretary to the Treasury. She's been an MP since 1992. She's been Parliamentary Secretary of State for Social Security, Minister of State for Pensions, and Exchequer Secretary to the Treasury, amongst other things, I am sure. So, Angela, over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Mandy, and it's a pleasure to be here on a beautiful day like this discussing the things that really matter. All of us, I think, in this room would agree that re-establishing our economic credibility with the electorate is a necessary prerequisite for victory at the next general election. And I think it's also clear, though, that any party, whether neoliberal or progressive, which was in government when the money markets froze, was actually going to suffer a blow to its economic credentials. This was a moment, an event really, of real severity and danger. It caused the first synchronised global recession since the Second World War, and it caused government deficits to rise the world over, not just in the UK. The financial collapse of 2008 has created a new economic context. It should have heralded the end of the free market model of macroeconomics, which has dominated thinking since the Reagan-Thatcher era. After all, it's been tested to destruction by these events. And yet the paradox is that parties of the right have won elections everywhere since the credit crunch hit. And they've turned their crisis into one of public spending and debt. And it's our progressive duty, I believe, to work with other social democratic parties to challenge this discredited economic system and replace it with something which is fairer and more sustainable. And I think that's the background to all of the discussions we have to have in this area. I think the challenge for Labour is to recover and rebuild our economic reputation in this changing context and mould that changing context to something which benefits the progressive side of politics. I think we need to be honest about what we did right, and I think we need to acknowledge where we went wrong. But I don't think this means we should accept every politically motivated caricature of our economic record, which is thrown at us by our opponents. I think a masochistic display of mea culpa will not win us the next election. It will only play into the Tories' hands. I think we especially should not accept the lie, and I'm choosing my words extremely carefully, the lie that this crisis was caused by the last Labour government's profligate spending on schools and hospitals, nor that its origins were domestic and not international. The reality is that this was a global crisis of the right, of neoliberal free markets and untrammelled greed in the banking system. It was not a crisis of state spending. We went into that global crisis with lower national debt than America, France, Germany and Japan, and a lower debt and deficit than we inherited from the previous Conservative government. The deficit we must deal with now was actually an inevitable consequence of the coordinated action taken to save global banking systems and prevent a recession turning into a worldwide depression. The Tories called every decision during this crisis wrong, and they were isolated internationally in their opposition to the fiscal stimulus. Their subsequent political choice to eliminate the deficit in 4 years, cutting deeper and faster, has actually caused our economy to flatline and snuffed out the nascent recovery which Labour's fiscal response to the crisis had created. Recent data has confirmed that George Osborne has put the UK into the slow lane of Europe. If you look at growth in the last 6 months, we are languishing just ahead of Greece and Portugal, overtaken in the growth figures by France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Spain, even Spain. And Germany is powering ahead. So they have irresponsibly claimed that Britain was on the brink of a sovereign default when we weren't, to justify the largest spending cuts in the UK's peacetime history, and they've collapsed confidence in the UK economy in the process. They are essentially playing Russian roulette with our economy to pursue a political strategy and create enough space for tax cuts, which they hope to offer before the next election. They have no plan for growth or jobs. They seem indifferent to the plight of an entire generation of young people who are now languishing on the dole. And they appear to think that presiding over the largest and longest squeeze in living standards for 80 years to eliminate the deficit faster is an acceptable price to pay, whilst those who enrich themselves in the banking crisis are unaffected by the austerity measures. One of the ways, I think, that we will regain our economic credibility is to be right in our warnings about the consequences of the economic decisions that the Tories have taken since the last election, and I believe we are doing that work now. It's not just that the hit to living standards of public services is hurting, and that going too far too fast isn't working. The higher inflation, higher unemployment and slower growth now forecast means that even on his own calculations, George Osborne will have to borrow £46 billion more than he planned to just last year in his first budget. In contrast, our approach to get the deficit down in a steadier way was actually putting jobs and growth first, and it was beginning to work. A year ago, the economy was starting to grow, unemployment was falling, and borrowing had come in £21 billion lower than forecast, rather than £46 billion higher than forecast. Our policy review should enable us to reapply our unchanging values of economic efficiency, fairness and social justice to a post-credit crunch world, but we must accept and understand that we are not and never will be in the position that we were in before the credit crunch. This is such a seminal moment. Labour needs to evolve to meet new challenges and address the lessons we've learned from the economic crisis and the general election, and I'm sure that nobody in this room needs reminding that we slumped to the second lowest share of the vote since 1929 in the democratic era, and therefore Labour politics can no longer be business as usual. So what did we get wrong? I think there are two main areas we need to focus on. First, we, like governments and central banks around the world, got bank regulation wrong, and we accepted too easily the free market mantra that globalisation in the money markets was spreading risk, reducing the dangers of cheap credit, when the opposite was actually true. We failed to appreciate the dangers posed by the rapid growth of a shadow banking system, which was totally unregulated. Driven by skewed remuneration incentives and greed, it grew to an unsustainable size. The fact that the Tories wished to deregulate even more does not absolve us of blame for this error. But why, though, did everyone get that so wrong? Why did nobody from central banks, from Mervyn King, vast numbers of academics on down, not see what was coming? The Tories' flagship project Merlin, which is a deal with the banks, is a damp squib, which doesn't even begin to address this problem, as the ongoing scandal of huge bank bonuses for those at the very top continues unabated. And I think that's why Ed Miliband is correct to have identified rights and responsibilities at the top as well as the bottom as a key theme for the forthcoming policy reviews. That's why we're calling on the government to repeat the bank bonus tax this year and use the money to build thousands of affordable homes, create 100,000 jobs, including for young people. And that's why Shadow Chancellor Ed Balls was also right to apologise for the mistakes that the last Labour government made on banking regulation. Secondly, I think we must take notice of the widening inequalities between the very top and bottom of the income distribution. This isn't only an issue of moral concern for all Social Democrats. The lessons of the financial collapse demonstrate that it's an issue of economic stability and sustainability too. The High Pay Commission has only recently published a report highlighting the accelerating gap between the UK's very high earners and the rest. The last Labour government policy, I think, produced some real success in tackling inequality and improving life chances. And I'm proud that we lifted 700,000 children out of poverty and changed many lives for the better. Sure Start was pioneering in its attack on the causes of disadvantage. The increases in education funding improved opportunity for all. But we were running up a downward escalator. Income differences were 40% greater at the end of the Thatcher major government than they'd been in the mid-1970s due to the Big Bang in the city and Tory policies on privatisation, deregulation and tax. We halted but did not reverse that trend. Much less did we alter the direction of that downward escalator or the speed at which it was travelling. So it's clear that income inequality is now set to soar once more, and the downward escalator looks like it's going faster. It's painful to realise that 13 years of real effort on poverty can be wiped out in just a few years of conservative austerity. Top pay continues to spiral out of control, and meanwhile there's acute pressure on living standards for everybody else. For the last 30 years, average wages have been rising slower than productivity, and the share of national wealth going to wages rather than profits has fallen into sharp decline, not only in this country, by the way, but in all advanced economies. And we need to think about what that means and what we can do about it. It was down from 65% in 1973 to just 53% today. And as profits are distributed far more unevenly than wages, this trend has taken money from the many and given it to the few, especially those at the very top. So we need to acknowledge and respond to the increased insecurity and financial pressures on both low and middle income earners caused by this wages squeeze. And I think we need to acknowledge that this began before the credit crunch hit. And that's why Ed Miliband is right to focus on that area of work in the policy review too. Greater equality improves the well-being of the entire population, therefore everyone has an interest in bringing it about. We need to revive the debate about how best to achieve this in a globalised and increasingly interconnected world where tax competition gets even fiercer. This is not anti-aspiration, it just means that everybody can aspire. It's about creating the right conditions for productive, well-paying job creation. It's about self-employment, it's about good career progression. It's about education, innovation and skills in a dynamic economy, and it's about paying our way in the new world economy, which is going to be an increasingly important area for us to think about. So to those of you who are impatient with our progress, I say we need to be patient but not complacent. There's a rhythm to opposition. I've done it before, unfortunately, and I know about it. The public aren't inclined to listen to you immediately after you've lost a general election. Like you, though, I'm anxious for a swift return to government. But we have a long fight ahead to win back the nation's trust. Remember, nostalgia for a lost leader is no substitute for the hard graft of renewal. Tony Blair did not win a leadership election 6 months after an election defeat. And if he had, his approach would have been very different to the one he took 15 years later. It's our job to make sure that the next Prime Minister of the Labour Party doesn't have a 15-year gap in which to hone his appeal to the electorate. So over the coming weeks and months, myself and other shadow cabinet members will be continuing to move around the country talking to the very people whose trust we lost. We'll be listening to what they think is wrong and with the current government, and we'll also be talking to them about our mistakes. And above all, we want the British public to contribute to our renewal process. We will not win our economic credibility back overnight. We've started the process by highlighting the reckless approach the Conservatives are taking with our future economic prosperity and how their no growth, no jobs budget has made the squeeze on living standards worse and is actually making it harder to get the deficit down. Something I think, if you read between the cracks and lines of Vince Cable's piece in The Guardian today, he is now admitting. But we must be ready to take bold steps to introduce fresh ideas into our future economic programme in the post-credit crunch era, and I look forward to collecting a few of those in the debate today. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Angela. And thank you for setting the scene from on behalf of the Shadow Cabinet. I'm posing some questions, and I think, you know, as somebody who joined the party in 1997, I have no experience as an activist of being in opposition, so I think it's actually quite important for all of us to listen to people who were actually members of Parliament in opposition as well, because I think we've got a lot to learn on how we act as a party in opposition. I'm going to ask the rest of the panel to stick to their 5 minutes. Angela got more because she was setting the scene for us, so that we can open it up to people who have come to watch. So next we have Lord Liddell, who's chair of the Policy Network. He's previously chair of Lord Mandelson's advisory panel on new industry, new jobs, universities and skills. In his past life, amongst other things, he has been advisor to the President of the European Commission, to Lord Mandelson and Tony Blair whilst he was Prime Minister.
Thank you very much, Mandy. I think we've got to... There's a great danger on this panel that we spend the whole time agreeing with each other, because I thought that every sentence of Angela's speech I agreed with. I agree on her analysis of the mistakes of the past, that the main mistake was failure to regulate the financial system properly. I agree that that we neglected inequalities, and the question of rights and responsibilities at the top as well as the bottom is a key question for the future. I agree that we didn't have a balanced enough approach to our economy, which is what we were trying to address with our active industrial policy in the last 18 months of government, but I think we came to that too late. I also agree with a lot of the positive points she made, which I think that we mustn't depart from. I don't think the Labour government spent too much, and I think this is very important. I am absolutely adamant that our spending policy was a responsible one. There was a lot of catch-up investment needed in public services. I think we did the right thing. Secondly, I think we did absolutely the right thing in handling the 2008 crisis, and I think Gordon Brown will go down in history as having saved Britain and the developed world from a repeat of the 1930s. And I think that his historical record will withstand the cheap jibes of David Cameron and Nick Clegg about our policies. And thirdly, I do think that Angela and Ed Balls have got it right in terms of the critique of the present government's approach. The cuts are far too deep for the present fragility of the British economy. They are a very great risk, and when you look at what the chief economist of the Bank of England is saying this morning in the Financial Times interview, that, you know, he thinks interest rates are going to have to rise, then that makes, if that is so, then the scale of the spending cuts in the present situation, I think, is really quite alarming for prospects for the British economy. So I agree wholeheartedly with the approach that they are taking as our Treasury opposition. Now, just a few points, though, that I think were to try and inject some debate here. I think in saying the cuts are too fast, too deep, we've got to make sure we don't give the impression that the left favours high deficits, high public sector deficits in principle. There's nothing left-wing about high deficits. The interest payments which they require could be better spent on real public services. The interest payments represent transfers from the taxpayer to bondholders, which tend to be transfers from younger people to older people and from poorer people to richer people on the whole. There's also a specific point about Britain and deficits, that because of the scale of the banking system in our economy, we are very exposed to another financial crisis should one occur. Therefore, as fast and prudently as we can, without damage to economic growth, we have to get the deficit down, because if there was another financial crisis, we would be running very grave risks as we are. And we also have to face up to the fact that if the 2008 crisis has caused permanent structural damage to the British economy, then, you know, we might not be able to afford the same kind of size of spending that we thought we could afford in 2008. So those are difficult issues that I think the left has to face up to. I think that one of the mistakes we did make, and this is treading into very difficult territory, which is the territory of tax. And I think I can just about, from my position in the House of Lords, get away with talking about tax, whereas I think that Angela will find it quite difficult. The truth is that we made a mistake. The mistake wasn't on spending in the last decade. The mistake was on overestimating government revenues, on mistaking the revenues that came from the financial services and speculative bubble of the 2000 decade as permanent increases in tax revenue. It was an understandable mistake to make, but it does mean that when we're looking to the future, we have to look for new and more stable and soundly based sources of revenue to finance a welfare state. Some of that should come from the rich, and I think we've got to look at taxes on capital transfers, taxes on property, where I think that the better off in this country get away with murder in terms of property. But we also have to look at the question of broad, if we want a generous welfare state, how do we build political consensus for the broad base of taxation that you need in order to pay for it? Now, in 2002, we were doing that. We raised national insurance to pay for our increased spending on health. I think we've got to look again at those questions of how we build public consent for a more generous public services and welfare state, and I think we've got to look again at questions of hypothecation of tax, which in the past we rejected. Second point, and I'll end on this point, I've probably got on too long already, Mandy, I think that we've got to think through the implications of the fact that we were over-dependent on the City of London for revenue and for growth. Now, as I mentioned, under Peter Mandelson at BIS in the last phase, we were trying to develop the active industrial policy. But the other side is to have a credible policy for financial services in the city. I think that's a very difficult area where, in government, we rescued the banks, but then we weren't able to set out a credible vision for what we thought should happen to financial services in terms of regulation, in terms of competition, in terms of dealing with the risks that this imposed to the British economy. A lot of hard thinking is necessary here, I think that there are lots of trade-offs between the potential benefits to Britain, given that we have the City of London as a great competitive strength for Britain, but the risks that at the same time potentially we run. And I think we've only started, really, on the process of thinking about those issues. And with that, Mandy, I'll sit down.
Thank you very much. Let's move on to Ben Shimshon, who is director at Britain Thinks, he specialises in providing clients with campaign and communication advice rooted in qualitative and quantitative insight. You have given advice to McDonald's, the Labour Party, eBay, PwC and Age UK, amongst others. Ben.
Hi. Okay, I'm just going to talk a little bit about kind of whether there is a kind of economic credibility deficit in the published polling and in the kind of work that we do in focus groups and things like that. And I think there are three areas that are maybe not deficits, but they're definitely areas where there's a lag between where Labour is and where they could be. And the first of those is that the government is losing popularity and support, particularly in the economic sphere, but that loss of confidence, as everyone said, I think, in the first opening plenary, isn't accruing to Labour at the moment. So the government approval has fallen from kind of plus 20% last year in June to a minus 20% this last Tuesday. View that the coalition is managing the economy well has fallen from kind of plus 24 to minus 13 over the same period. Nearly 70% of people think they're being negatively affected by the cuts. 50% think the cuts are too deep. Only 6% think they're too shallow. 57% think the cuts are being made too fast. 5% think they're being made too slowly. And nearly 60% think the cuts are being done unfairly. So there's loads of space there for a kind of public opinion to move away from the coalition and towards Labour. But that hasn't happened at the moment, and I think we've had some reasons why that might be. But Labour trails the Tories on management of the economy between kind of 5 and 10% is the lag, depending on which poll you look at. The second kind of area where there's a gap is between our vote share. It's a bit more puzzling, between our vote share and our share of economic confidence. So if you look at kind of analysis of the British election surveys by people like Whiteley and Clark and those kind of academic surveys, they show a really consistent relationship between what are called valence issues, economic competence, managing down crime, those kinds of things where everybody knows broadly what the end game is. They want a growing economy and they want to reduce crime and kind of vote share. So the economy is by far the most important of those valence issues, and right now it's the most important issue, full stop. Kind of 50% of people mention it as one of their top two most important issues, and about 40% mention it as their first most important issue. What we've seen in the last 6 months is a divergence between Labour's poll ratings and the proportion of people who think that Labour would be best at managing the economy. It's about 30% for managing the economy, and it's about 40% of people saying that they'd vote Labour. That isn't an unheard of difference, but it is an important gap, and it's lasted quite a while, and it's been moving it's been growing. The last couple of times Labour's had a lead which wasn't supported by a lead on the economy, the last time was in 1997, in the months just leading up to the election. So Labour had for about 2 years a lead on managing the economy, and it started to dip back down just ahead of the election, I think probably as the electorate got the jitters before voting Labour, and the poll lead stayed steady through that time. The time before that was 1992, when Labour had a lead in the polls for a long time, but had been steadily behind on economic competence. And I think a lot of people drew a lot of important lessons from that at that time. There's also a third kind of gap between where the public are on the economy and how they view Labour, and that is that the public think the cuts are necessary. About 58%, in fact, say that they're necessary. 30% think that they're not, and the rest say they don't know. In our focus groups, the view is, and Deborah spoke about this earlier, the view is that Labour is just against the cuts. So the kind of takeout from our message is that we're against the cuts that the public think are necessary, and that is an important gap in public perception. And the problem is, not only do they think the cuts are necessary, they also think that Labour are to blame for the cuts, even when the banks are included in the polling question, and that's really important. And I think one of the kind of mistakes we made communications-wise is that Labour did very well at when the problem was about the economic collapse, of bringing in those outside forces of the international banking crisis and things like that into people's views of what was going on. But as that shifted towards management of the public finances, and the Conservatives are very, very rigorous about talking about this in terms of public finances, not in terms of the economy, it shifts away from things that the whole world affects to things that government's responsible for, very squarely. And so the result of that is that the blame accrues to Labour around the deficit. And underlying that is, I think, a kind of long-term brand issue, which is that Labour's economic credentials were very hard won, and they were hard won against a backdrop of people thinking that we don't spend particularly carefully. And those kind of spendthrift associations, they die harder, they're there, and when people hear things that kind of chime with them, they kind of internalise those views. So I think Labour needs to think not only about how our narrative plays out in terms of where the economy is going, but also in terms of how the way we're talking about the cuts and the deficit chime with what people think about Labour at that kind of deeper level. Even if the economy tanks and credibility seeps away from the Conservatives, we can't really assume that we're going to pick up that credibility just by having warned or been right at this stage.
Thank you, Ben. Michael Stevenson was elected General Secretary to the Co-op Party in July of 2008. He was previously advisor at 10 Downing Street and spent many years as a political advisor in Australia. You will probably have seen he often writes in The Guardian about a cooperative approaches to economics, politics and the financial crisis.
Thanks, Mandy. I'm a late replacement for Kitty Usher, so if you've come here just to see Kitty, you'll be disappointed, but I'll do my best. As a late addition to the list, I'm going to make my comments very brief, therefore. Take a slightly different tack to the earlier speakers and kick off with three observations about this whole question about Labour and economic credibility or competence. The first is a really obvious one, but I think it needs to be stressed as often as possible, and that is, whether we like it or not, it's always much, much harder for Labour governments and Labour parties to achieve credibility in the eyes of particularly swinging voters. And it's also, as we've seen in recent months, much, much easier for us to lose that credibility very quickly. And one of the most annoying spectacles, I think, of the last 2 years has been the way in which all the good work that Alistair Darling and Gordon Brown did over those years when we were in government has just been somehow thrown away. And I just think that's a typical sort of, if you like, universal truth about Labour parties all over the world. And as Mandy said, having worked in Australia, it's the same situation there. The second observation I'd like to make is just this, the irony that we're talking about this, and the flip side of what I've just said, is that when we're in government, we've never really nailed the mythology about this alleged golden legacy of the Tories. I remember when I was working for the party, it was Michael Duggar, who in a previous incarnation had done some fantastic work about basically what we actually inherited in 1997. And I don't think we were ruthless enough in actually prosecuting that case. And I think in some respects, when you don't take that opportunity, some of that comes back to haunt you in later years. The third observation, I think, is a lot of the discussion that we've seen on this question is very much at a macro level. And I think there's a real opportunity for Labour to take that debate down to a more micro level. And I think that's really about how we... I should say at this point as well, though, Angela and the Treasury team have done a good job in talking about, obviously, the cuts and the squeezed middle. But I think there's a real opportunity for Labour to talk more about how individual people are affected by the economy, how individual people are affected by markets, how they relate to them. And the reason I think this is really important now is the credit crunch. Because I think the current economic crisis is very different to any other recession we've had. Because I think for the first time in decades, people are actually not only ruining the things that have happened to them, but also questioning the values of the institutions that have brought this upon them, both government, but also, most notably in the context of what we talk about here, the banks. And I think the opportunity for Labour in this respect is bigger than that. And it's about building an economy in which people have a say, and giving the notion to people that the economy and markets can actually work for them rather than something that happens to them. Now, I think Labour did this for a certain extent with some success in its period of government, but if you think back to that time, I think a lot of our approach to markets and the economy was about proving to people that we understood markets and we weren't hostile to them. I think we have to go beyond that now, because I think we're now facing, as I say, not only a new economic crisis, but one in which people view that crisis very differently. And unsurprisingly and totally predictably, I will say to you that one way we can address this is by adopting a more cooperative and mutual approach to our economy. I think the idea of co-ops and mutuals is a very strong traditional notion of the left. It's been around for a long, long time, and its time has come back in terms of the current debate. And I think, as I say, if we have this opportunity at the moment to build a more genuine stakeholder economy and also to develop some tools of financial inclusion. The how of how we do that is really up to members of the Labour Party and Angela and the Treasury team. But I'll kick off with a couple of ideas in this respect, five in fact, three of which are about the sort of private sector or the financial sector. One is we should remutualise Northern Rock, because the last government encouraged all these wonderful mutual organisations that were rooted in our values to go under. We've got an opportunity to put that right as a symbolic gesture, but also something which puts some much-needed mutuality into the financial sector and civilises the behaviour of those appalling banks. The second thing we should look at in terms of this alternative economy, or this new economy, should be about developing credit unions and other ways in which we can get access to finance for more vulnerable people. It's a very, very underdeveloped sector in the UK compared to other places. And also, I think, access to finance at all levels is clearly one of the key challenges as we come out of the economic recovery. The third idea I'd like to see us investigate would be the notion of a Financial Inclusion Act, a bit like what the Americans have with their Community Reinvestment Act. In other words, putting a bit of a social obligation on banks to see what they should be doing in their local communities and not just as a market player. And on the private sector side, I think we should be developing and supporting the growth of employee ownership. But more importantly, I think beyond that, the growth and development of cooperative businesses, cooperative enterprises. A lot of the debate has been about David Cameron and this sort of false notion of mutuals in the public sector. I think there's a real opportunity as we go forward to build a different type of private sector with different types of organisations. And as I say, one in which we give people a say in how the economy is run, and we set up some institutions that they have that they can recognise some values that they also share. So I'll leave it on that.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you very much to the panel. I'm now going to open it up to you. My goodness, right? I haven't even asked you to put your hands up. If you can tell us your name and if you're from an organisation, and keep your question as brief as possible, because as you can see, there's people already want to ask. So we'll go this gentleman here, this lady here, and this gentleman here. Don't worry, I'll come to the rest of you. Yes. I don't know, do we have microphones? No, we don't have anyone to do the runner. If you can stand up and shout.
I couldn't make any more of the speak. It's not like the line to say that the Labour Party was responsible for the national crisis and the rest of it at all, and what the Tories constantly say in the media. My question is for everyone. My question is, why does this message not come through any of the media and the public?
Yes. So essentially, why isn't the media listening to our message? Yeah, and touting out the coalitions. Next question. We have. Thank you so much.
Jane Roberts, it's taking precisely that question and further on. I kind of wept with frustration over the course of the last year that all our spokespeople haven't come out, it appears, despite the wonderful critique that I think Angela's just given. Three key messages that are repeated by every single Labour spokesperson that's asked on interviews to refute that. I've heard so many times Nick Clegg, Vince Cable say we're cleaning up the mess, and actually just three key messages, boring, consistent, because I'm not sure it's not that the media's picking it up. I'm not convinced that we have, from the leadership all the way down, it's not those three key points.
Thank you.
Martin Phillips, I'm a member of the Prosperity and Work Policy Commission, so I represent party members on the body that debates economic policy. Labour came out of big industry, and it seems to me we've got a major opportunity, and I'm going to quote Margaret Thatcher's message. Margaret Thatcher was the son of a shopkeeper and kept talking about being daughter of a shopkeeper. I kept talking about it. I was thinking back to the spitting image puppet. Small business is where all the growth is. If you look at the list of the fastest growing companies, the companies that are putting on all the jobs, they're all coming out of small businesses and medium-sized businesses. Labour has never really had a message for that sector. Yeah. There is no point talking to Honda and Tesco and people like that, because all these jobs that we need to create are going to come out of companies none of us have ever heard of. So I think we need to work on that. And just a very quick comment, and I think it relates to the credibility thing. Can we never, ever, ever have a Labour Chancellor say again, we've brought an end to boom and bust, because it was hubris at the time, and I think that's one of the reasons we lost credibility, when our leader was the guy who said we'd brought an end to boom and bust, and then we had a massive bust. I don't think that helped our credibility.
Okay, thank you. Panel, for sack to you, Angela.
Well, it is frustrating when you've got an alternative narrative and it's not getting through. These narratives have been put out through the party, they've been put out through the PLP. I say them as often as I can. Ed Ball says them as often as he can. I think we're clearing up the last lot's mess, and we were in government when the crisis happened, are difficult things to get over, and you can only get over that in time. It's a source of frustration to me too, but we're not all puppets. We've got the stuff out there. People go on. I think Labour people like to engage with the arguments instead of doing mantras, because they somehow think that if you do a mantra about something that it's beneath the arguments. We always have, I don't know, I think it's something in our psychology. All I can say is that from the economic team, we do it as much as we can. But I'm as frustrated as you are about it. I think, though, it is a bit about the rhythm of opposition. And I think that there are some issues in that. I was interested in what Michael was saying about how we didn't do enough of that when we took control of the government from the Tories in 1997. You know, you think about how effective they are at it, because you think of things like the winter of discontent, and immediately all of those connections occur. How did we characterise the Thatcher Major government when I've said that there was a 40% increase in inequality during that time? We haven't been able to pin a characterisation on them, apart from that the Tories are the nasty party. That's not a bad one to begin working with, but, you know, it's just... I think it's something about us having a more elevated view of debate on the left somehow. But we've done our best to get the narrative across, and we must just keep at it. But I share your frustrations. In terms of what Martin was saying, obviously, I think the SME sector is really important, and also self-employment as well. And I think we need to look at how we can engage in a more effective way with that than we have in the past. It's a more difficult sector to get to grips with. It doesn't have lobbying structures in the same way as the bigger industry does and all of that. But I do think we need to look at skills. We need to look at the environment for business creation. We need to think about self-employed employment and how that works. We need to think about women and self-employment. And I hope that there'll be some important areas of our policy review that will focus on that. You're absolutely right. That's where a vast majority of job creation is going to come from.
Thank you. Ben?
So I'm just going to talk about why I think that maybe the messages haven't cut through. I think the first thing is, I think message discipline is really important, and I think that there is a tendency to make a speech and feel like we've done it. I don't think it is often even close to have being heard. But I think there's a broader thing, which is that kind of people internalise the messages that chime with what they already think, and they think that politicians would say that, wouldn't they, anyway? And they certainly think that politicians would defend themselves. And so I think that kind of that they find it quite easy to internalise ideas that Labour ruined the economy because they're in a bad place, and that's quite easy for them to hold in their heads. It's much harder for them to internalise a defence of the record because, well, the politicians would say that anyway. And that means that there's a need for kind of to break that. You need to be much more disruptive. It's not a case of just putting an alternative argument. you need to say something that changes the way that they think about you. And it has to be, you have to do it hard, and you have to say, show it in really kind of visceral, symbolic, and visual ways.
On the problems that we have of communication, I'm one of those who think that we didn't do enough before the election to put flesh on the bones of the Alistair Darling deficit reduction plan. And I think that if we'd done that, we would probably have done better in the election. That's my view. I know there are arguments the other way, so I'm not being dogmatic about this, but I believe if we'd put more flesh on the bones, we might have done better in the election. But certainly we would have been better placed having lost the election, because we could turn around credibly and say, well, we were serious about the deficit as well. I also think another factor which has really damaged us was that, because we had this leadership election hiatus, and that's no one's fault, right? But what happened in that period was that, whereas the Liberal Democrats had been wholly in support of our position in the run-up to the general election, that cutting was, you know, a bit too fast, was dangerous, and they supported our opposition to immediate Tory cuts. With the form, they switched their position in the creation of the coalition, bought wholly into the George Osborne economic strategy. And I think with the public, that gave a real credibility to the Osborne strategy and the argument that we were facing a crisis, and that this, and because they endorsed it. I think this is a terrible mistake that they have made, but I do think that it has damaged us a lot. I think that, you know, people liked the formation of the coalition, whatever they think of it now, and they were prepared to believe what it said about the economy at a time when we didn't have a leader and we were rather disabled from getting a message across.
I agree with a lot of what's been said. I should say I've got a great deal of sympathy for Angela having to get across any messages with journalists, because it's a very cynical mood out there. I also think it's very good that we actually do have a coherent narrative about it now, and I've heard lots of representatives of both the opposition and the party say it. But I think there's probably time now to inject a little bit of a balance in that narrative between numbers and other ideas. And I think it's sort of what I said before about, I think it's really important if we can connect what happens in the economy with what happens in people's lives. We can take the numbers, if you like, and say the result of what happened is this, and how it affects you in your everyday life will go some way towards addressing that. And I think we have to have that balance, as I say, between economic fact, numbers, and real life experience, what it actually means.
Thank you. Right, more questions? Right, I'm going to take people from the sides as well. That gentleman there, that gentleman at the very back, and the only woman asking a question at the moment, here at the front. And thank you to our self-appointed microphone bearer. Yeah,
I'm David Phillips. I'm from Wales, actually. I just stood in the Welsh Assembly elections in North Wales. And, of course, we've got a Labour government in Wales, so, you know, Wales is leading the way there. I would agree with Michael on the need for a greater role for cooperatives, you know, and certainly mutualising Northern Roc. At the micro level, there is a lot of scope there to include the cooperatives, so that the people having a sense of ownership in enterprise, and to bring enterprise and the cooperative values closer together. Just on the macro, from the points that have been made, Angela's making, on the macro level, I'm very optimistic, actually, about the future, but the danger, the real challenge is the Bank of England, the money that's being the money that's being created is not going into productive enterprise, but it's more money printing, which is just financial assets, and that is what's causing inflation, which is actually going to really devastate the people, the majority of the people who we represent. And the reason, I would actually give the reason that we have this split. You know, they're saying that the top 5% have got richer and the rest. The reason, one of the main reasons, is that they are more flexible. They put their money into precious metals, you know, hard assets which don't erode with inflation, and everybody else who can't do that. That's how why people are suffering. That's but just one solution for the banks. Split, have a lower corporation tax rate for the banks if they invest in, for example, expand this green bank initiative so that you're investing in people and empowering people, and have a higher rate of corporation tax if they invest in the, you know, these risky ventures.
Thank you very much. This woman here.
Alexandra Kemp from Northwest Norfolk. Can we change our communication strategy so, like Cameron, we do encapsulate what we say in short nuggets that people actually take hold of? Because in the election campaign, there were so many people saying there is no alternative to the cuts, and they'd obviously listened to Cameron, and they were just repeating it. But when you actually scratch beneath the surface, you actually challenge them on it, you particularly three key points. You said, well, Labour actually spent the money well. We got the hospital waiting list down. We built SureStart. We built new schools. People started to think, and then you said, well, it all started in the 80s with demutualisation, with all the core profits being taken out, paid out in windfalls. There was no buffer left. The risks from that, also the fact that public sector spending was much, much less than what was being given to the bankers at the crisis. People started thinking, particularly people who were quite responsible, typical Tory voters, they were thinking this isn't quite right. And thirdly, on unemployment, and I think we really have to push home, as we've said, that unemployment is a characteristic of Tory governments. We're getting it back again, and it's not a price worth paying because it affects people themselves, their families, their communities, and it's 2.5 million. And I think we've got to keep repeating that because that's what works.
Thank you very much. I do apologise, I've chosen somebody right on the other side at the back. Yeah, probably.
Very quick one. When the Tories offer a pre-election tax bribe just before the next election, what are the advantages and disadvantages of either matching the tax cut or trying to spend the money on public services?
Great, thank you very much. Angela, do you mind if we start with you again? Because it seems to be...
Okay, I think in terms of David, I'll write down your tax proposal and feed it into the sausage machine. I'm not allowed to say anything about potential tax proposals at the moment. You know, I came into politics to have opinions and say things, but when you're in my sort of job, you have to be quite careful how you express it, especially if it's the T word. But I think that there are some interesting new ideas out there that the Policy Review must look at about new forms of taxation in order to shore up tax bases, as Roger mentioned, which are being eroded by tax competition and some of the changes that have happened in global finance markets. And I think it's important that we spend the next period looking at some of those. Some of them can only be really put into effect if you can get international agreement, but others are more interesting. And I think that there's an entire agenda about how you can make tax revenues more sustainable, systems simpler than it's been at the moment, and accommodate some of the changes that have gone on with developments in international money markets. In terms of different levels of corporation tax, the sort of ex-Exchequer Secretary bit of me would say that when you have differences, there are always potential loopholes and unintended consequences, but all of these things are worth looking at. In terms of tax bribes, I mean, I think it's a moot point quite how what the current government's economic policy will actually mean. In their original so-called farcically named emergency budget, they were going to pay off the deficit within 4 years and have a whole year of billions of pounds to give away in tax cuts come the next election. But actually, they're now 64 billion off target with that. And if growth continues to flatline, they'll be considerably further, of course. I think we have to remember that this government have voluntarily signed us up for the largest fiscal consolidation in the advanced economies outside of Iceland and Ireland. And I think it's wise to remember that. Probably much worse than what the IMF would have imposed in the 70s. Now, I think it's wise to remember that. So I'm quite sceptical as to whether they'll get there. And like all shadow chief secretaries to the Treasury, my sort of answer to your question is, well, when we get there, we'll have a look and see what the best thing is. But I think that the narrative has got to be that this is not an economic policy that George Osborne is pursuing. It's a blatantly political policy, which he's trying to bend the economy to. The front-end loaded nature of the cuts is entirely a political strategy. And what it does is risk economic recovery by front-end loading the cuts now, just when the signs of economic recovery are fragile and there is massive uncertainty in the world economy as to what's actually happening, especially in the area that is our main market, which is the Eurozone. So I think I'd rather talk about it like that, but I take your point. Those decisions that would be made much closer to the time. In terms of and no bets should be off, by the way, you should consider everything. In terms of the analysis, I think some of your answers, I didn't get your name at the front. Some of your answers on the doorstep are important ones, particularly on unemployment being a characteristic of Conservative governments. And I think that we need to think about how we caricature them, because they've caricatured us pretty badly.
Ben? On the tax bribe thing, I think it depends on is it a tax cut for whom and spending on what, really. I think if we spend on something that runs with the grain of what people think we kind of spend on, and I think Ivan Lewis summed that up from the public's perspective, you know, people do think that we give money to immigrants and benefits cheats and people like that. I think if we are countering a tax cut with something that can be characterised in that way, we're not going to be in a good place. But whether we can spend it in a different way, that might be right. It might be as good as matching a tax cut. Can we reduce what we're saying to key points? Yeah, I think it doesn't need to be a mantra. I think we need a lens. We need a thing that we are saying about ourselves against which we check what we're saying. So to take an old example, Obama's 2008 campaign, they talked about change outwardly. On the inside of their office, above the door, they had the words remedy, not replica. Everything they said, whatever the policy area, had to say, we are a remedy, not a replica, to politics as usual. And that's how they thought about how they frame their communications. And we need something that is what we are, that we can talk through, no matter what policy area we're talking about. Because in the end, people won't ever get anywhere on our kind of the minutiae of our tax policy. What they want is this a tax policy that chimes with the views that I hold about what's right, what's wrong, and with my aspirations for my working life and my family life? I think that's what's important.
Thank you, Ben. Roger?
Yes, on tax, I think Ben's absolutely right. The key Labour principle should be that if they propose tax cuts, we should propose something fairer, right?
I've written that down.
I think in terms of, let's think about where we're going to be in a couple, 2 or 3 years' time. An example of where I think you might be able to make a case for some kind of hypothecated tax. Think what's happening to social care for the elderly at the moment as a result of the cuts. I mean, it's absolutely devastating what councils are going to have to do. They've got no financial alternative in terms of cuts in social care. Very, very vulnerable people. In the election, we proposed a national care service. I think a very attractive idea. And I think that in 2 or 3 years' time, people might say, well, yes, you know, I am prepared to contribute extra to make sure that we have proper, decent care for people at the end of their lives who are very vulnerable. And and you know, that's the sort of thing we ought to be thinking about. I'm not just floating it as an idea. And the other thing I'd say on is that Angela is absolutely right about tax competition. One of the things that George Osborne did in his latest budget was cut corporation tax. I don't believe that there's much benefit to growth from that, that the major reason for doing it is to try and prevent companies moving headquarters and projects probably to other places in Europe. I think we've got to look at the question of European and international tax coordination with much greater enthusiasm, let's put it like that, than we have in the past.
Thank you. Michael?
Just quickly on Alex's point about communications. I mean, we talked a lot, I think, today about the rhythm of opposition. I mean, I think one of the things that's really important we fail to place enough emphasis on is the nature of opposition. Because in the old days, you know, we're a totally different world now. So we've got a coalition, which of itself is unusual. We've got a Tory party that's not as seen as nasty as it used to be. And we were in power for 13 years. We've actually, for the first time in our history, had a solid track record. They've sampled the product. So really, in terms of our communications, one thing I think we need to get right is that understanding the nature of it, because, as I say, the punters have been able to judge us. And I think going forward, one of the key elements, and someone said this, I think, earlier this morning, about getting that right in economic credibility, is how we're perceived on the question of the state, where Labour stands on the state. Because it seems to me that electorally we only get popular when we're able to address our relationship with the state in terms of both social justice and aspiration. And that delivers us the sort of coalition that gets us into power. And it seems to me that because we're in this unusual place, because, as I say, the Tories aren't as nasty and the world's changed, we've got a real task there in getting that right, I think, was one of the key bits of the communication strategy, before we even get to the length of words or whatever.
Thank you, Michael. I'm going to take one final round of questions. If you can ask a question, you must be brief. You must promise me you'll be brief, or you have to look after my toddler for the rest of the day. And then we're going to go this way in questions. Michael, down to Angela, and if you could give any closing comments at the same time, if that's okay, because we are running very late. That gentleman there, that man there in the blue blazer who's been waving at me, and that woman there.
Thank you very much, Lindsay Thomas. And I'll declare that I'm a regulator, been a long-standing regulator in the city, including Northern Rock and Landsbanky. Can I just say two quick things? The narrative is not entirely right, I'm afraid. The key drivers and initiators and why people did not spot the crisis was because it was to do with currency problems on a global scale and the capital flows that resulted principally between China and the US. So the US deficit was a major thing. And I say that because that has not been resolved yet.
No.
And that's important. The implication of that was that interest rates were held down for too long and should have been much higher. And that means in the long term, interest rates will be higher, right? Whatever happens about inflation, the average rate of interest rate will have to be higher than it was before. The third point from that is it meant that lots of people, including government, but private people, overinvested capital, principally in housing, but also in terms of the deficit. Why? Because the cost of capital was artificially low. Yep. Right? So I think we need to build some of that in to realise that we do need to cut our deficit, because we've now realised that, in fact, the cost of that capital will, in the long term, be higher than it was before. We would have expected, in economics and in the city, to have seen inflation as the impact of over-commitment of resource. We didn't see that because of these capital flows. So can I just say the last point, and that is our narrative is about productivity, it seems to me. We don't just help people because we don't like them being poor or we don't like them being disabled. We help them because they're on our team, and our team is about driving productivity. Unemployment reduces national productivity. And we want to mobilise all our resources in the right way to contribute to a stable and sustainable economy. And that's how we draw it together, I feel.
Thank you very much. And gentleman here, there, that one there, yes. You just pass it along. Thank you.
Jonathan Holman from Stevenage CLP. on the nugget to say over and over again, the Tories don't get bored of their message, neither we should we. Call it George Osborne's election strategy. Say it over and over and over again. The tax cut will come whether the economy's in the state to deliver it or not. And if they do it, or, and this is my question, whether the panel agrees, whether if they deliver the Treasury's outlined plans to give the UKFI shares in banks back to the people, whether that will seal the deal on the ultimate irony of the message that we were soft on banks, we knighted Sir Fred, and the Tories backed the people and gave the banks back to the people.
Great, thank you very much. And the final question is that woman at the front. Thank you very much for the microphone.
Thanks. Right. Cathy Levine from Chipping Barnet. The Coalition's economic policy is having a differentially bad effect on women, in that most of the cuts are falling on women, the benefits are being withdrawn from women, but we don't seem to be getting the support from women that we might expect as a reaction to that. I'd be interested to hear some comments about that.
Thank you. Michael, can we start with you?
You want a question or my final comment?
Your answers on your final comments.
Yeah, okay, just on the so the UKFI and bank shares thing, I think this is a really good opportunity for us for this reason. If it's being portrayed as sort of like Tell Sid Mark II, it sort of really plays nicely into our hands in the sense of, and once again, coming from a sort of cooperative background, there's a fundamental difference between people buying these things and then speculating for short-term profit leading to bad services or bad whatever down the track, and the idea of mutuality, in which basically you have people who are running and owning institutions and therefore have a stake in them. So I think there's a really good values-based response that we could use that on, and we're sort of working on that at the moment. But just in terms of concluding remarks, all I'd say is it seems to me that sort of the key bits about getting either retaining or getting back our economic credibility are around keeping it real, less numbers, more people, keeping it positive, talking about what we can achieve and understanding that we can't necessarily stick all the negative stuff on the Tories anymore, but also keeping it simple. I think picking a couple of simple policies and really running with those, I think that's my formulation anyway.
Thank you, Michael. Roger?
On what Cathy said, yes, I think it's an interesting observation that the impact is falling more on women than men. I tended to think of it in terms of falling more on younger people than older people. But of course, the changes in the pension age are pretty harsh for working class women. So I think there is quite a lot in what you say on that. On Jonathan, on the election strategy, Osborne's election strategy, I'm pretty confident, you know, that this deficit reduction plan is not going to be met. I think that they won't have the money to give away shares in the banks. I think they'll be desperately anxious to try and sell the shares in the banks for the highest possible price myself, but there we are. I don't think it's working. And on the gentleman over here, agreed with his comments about the causes of the crisis, and he's absolutely right, and this is something we haven't touched on, but we have got to present at the next election a credible strategy for sustainable growth. And the Tories' attempts to do this so far, the Coalition's attempts, are pathetic, frankly. Pathetic, their growth strategy. And I'm sure we can do a lot better than that.
Thank you. Ben?
Okay. On the issue around women, so from a public opinion point of view, there are two kind of important things I think that to know about the way women kind of answer poll questions and things like that. First is they're much less ready to kind of dress vague assumptions up as opinions than men, and that is very true. You see, don't knows are higher on most polling questions amongst women than amongst men, and they take longer to make their decisions about things, and they're more likely to say they don't know when things are at the kind of macro level. So they're much, much clearer on what they think about public services and have much more formed views around services that they use and services that they engage with. And there, I think that we ended up in a difficult place when we were in government because of something that Deborah identified called I've Been Lucky Syndrome, whereby people who had a great experience with the public service thought they were the only one who got away with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that we didn't address mm-hmm. that then. And I think now we need to, if we want to engage women with that issue of how the cuts are affecting them disproportionately, we need to do it through the lens of their relationship with the services they use, rather than at the high level, macro level. I think the other thing was Roger said that whatever we do in relation to the tax bribe, we should propose something fairer. I think it's important to keep in mind that when Labour sees unfairness, we see deserving people getting too little. And quite often amongst the public, when they see unfairness, they see undeserving people getting too much. And I think that's a really important thing to bear in mind.
Mm. Thank you, Ben. Angela?
Good, enjoyable, rich discussion, I think. I mean, Lindsay, I think it's amazing that you've come here and admitted that you are one of the regulators for lands banking. I think that... but I think you're right in your analysis about global imbalances and what happened to the price of credit, and you're also right to point out that the global imbalances have not been addressed, which leads to the point in not only macro but supra-planetary macro economics that we could have another similar situation. I think Gordon Brown's been saying this on the world stage, and clearly because we've had the kind of rescues of the global system that we have had, another such rescue wouldn't be possible given the amount of deficit that's had to be put on balance sheets of nations around the world. So we are in quite a perilous position. The imbalances won't work their way through before a welfare system and a proper domestic market is created in China, before America starts paying off some of the debt overhang that it's got, and all of those things. So we are in a very perilous situation from that point of view. And clearly that led to the cost of capital being far low, artificially low, a circumstance that people began to take for granted in the investment decisions they made, as you pointed out. And there are some big supra sort of international decisions about how we reorganise the Bretton Woods system, what we do about global international institutions, that I think is a whole other area that probably won't win us elections, but it's an area that we really need to think about as we go forwards with our social democratic partners in having a view of the world and how we can make it fairer and more sustainable, which ties in actually with sustainability issues and green issues. And it should, because of the cooperation that it requires, actually help to have a social democratic approach. But we haven't seen an electoral dividend from that yet, and that's a big issue. Jonathan, I think George Osborne's electoral strategy, playing Russian roulette with the British economy, all of those things are really important things that we need to get across. But I take the point that Ben's has been making about the lens through which these things have to be seen, and I think we need to do a lot more work about narrative and emotional appeal than we've managed to do. I think it's an issue for governments of the progressive and just progressive people in general don't talk in emotive language in general. They talk in logic, and we've got to get out of that habit and make much more appeals. I think, Cathy, you are absolutely right about the women being more affected than men. And I think there's been some interesting things going on in terms of that whole agenda. David Willetts's pronouncement that feminism has caused the lack of career opportunities for working class men caused absolute appalling reactions all over in 51% of the population, which mainly don't get picked up, by the way, in the mainstream media, because that's a male prism. But there's an awful lot of stuff going on under the surface with when the mask slips, and I think the mask slipped with Calm Down, Dear. I mean, I didn't cause a fuss about that before it had been caused spontaneously outside of Parliament. And I think it slipped again with Ken Clark's comments, not because we're now being opportunistic and wanting a harsher approach to law and order, but because 51% of the population thought, my God, do we have to get back to the era where no, we have to say that actually no can mean yes and judge morally that some rape victims are more deserving of sympathy than others? I mean, I think that's what the reaction from women to Ken Clark's comments was about.
And so there's very interesting things going on with women under the surface, undetected, I think, by the mainstream media, that we have to gather and harvest. They have a blind spot when it comes to women. They do not get it. They don't get how women's aspirations have changed. And when they display their real attitudes, we need to point out that the farcically named emergency budget hit women three times harder than men, and the spending review hit women twice as hard as men. Those women who are going to see huge increases in their pension ages are going to be a very powerful issue. Those women who are carers, who are having respite care taken away even as we speak, there's plenty of campaigning we can do. And can I finally agree with Roger again? We do need a credible strategy for sustainable growth, and that's what we'll be working to develop. The government at the moment don't think they need a strategy for growth because they think it happens spontaneously. That's what their economic ideology teaches them, which gives us an advantage. And I think Peter Mandelson had actually begun to do some very good work on that, and as Roger said, probably a bit too late for it to register, but we must continue and deepen our understanding of that as we go forward with our policy reviews.
Thank you very much. Thank you to everybody who's coming along to this very important discussion this morning. So I could ask you to join me in thanking the panel and have a nice one.